I'm Frank Jones. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
It's good to be here tonight, and it's good to be sober. And I want to thank Carlos for allowing me to participate at this meeting. This is the third year I've been here, the Thursday before Christmas, and the second year I've given Red a cake. And it's just nice to be here. It gets me away from all the hustle and bustle and the crap that's happening on what's coming up on Monday. And I don't know about you, but I'm an alcoholic, and I react to everything. And if I'm up here speaking or in heavy traffic or whatever, it gives me a lot of time to think about me and what I'm not going to get for Christmas and what Santa Claus isn't going to bring me, and one more time how I'm going to be screwed and left out. And the other thing it does is I figured it out. We get a Christmas list in our group, and there's about between 400 and 500 people on it. And I sit down and I make out the cards and everything. And the longer you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more people you know in your home group. My home group has over 1,000 people. So I make out Christmas cards and I get crazy. They cost a quarter a piece to send out now. So I send out all of them that I'm going to. And I don't know how you do Christmas. But after I mail out all my cards, I invariably get cards from people I didn't mail any to. And then I got to send them a card. You know, you want everybody to like you. I do. And so I got to sit down and mail them cards out. And I'll bet you money, up through Saturday, I'll start taking cards to the meeting with me of people that I got cards from on Saturday. Because I just get nuts over Christmas, and I just can't allow myself to do that. But, you know, if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work, I wouldn't be here tonight. And that's for those people that raise their hand as being in their first week or 30 days of sobriety. If Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work, I wouldn't be here, because I'm a comfort creature. I like to be comfortable. I like to feel good. And if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work, you'd have somebody else standing up here, and I wouldn't have drove 4 hours in the traffic to be here with a bunch of drunks tonight. But Alcoholics Anonymous does work, and I'm a blessed man, and I'm grateful that it does. And, you know, I have no reason to even be an alcoholic. For Christ's sakes, look at me. I'm looking good. Look around you. Look at the people sitting next to you. That's what alcoholics look like. They don't look like me. I come from a normal family. Mom and Dad, they're not alcoholic. You know, they didn't even hardly drink. Dad worked the same job for 40 years, and him and Mom been married 50. And they didn't drink. You know, I don't know where I picked it up at, you know, but I grew up in a good home. I had a good childhood. I was born in Danville, Illinois. And I had a great childhood, and I had a lot of fun, and I played ball, and I played sports, and I played with the girls from an early age, and I felt guilty about that, but it felt good, so I kept doing it. I just stuffed the guilt down, and, you know, I had a problem growing up with perfectionism, and I know you can't tell by looking at me, but I had a problem growing up, if things were out of place, it made me crazy. Mom and Dad would go grocery shopping or whatever, and I'd wash and wax the kitchen floor, polish furniture. And I don't know where that come from. I started ironing the sheets that I slept on. I started ironing my underwear. And I started playing doctor with a little girl next door. And I had to have something to offer, so I starched my skivvies and ironed them. And, you know, I grew up being a liar and a cheat and a thief, and I didn't plan that because I come from a good home. But I grew up stealing and lying and cheating, and I carried that through into my adulthood, and every time I did those things, I felt guilty, but I had to stuff that guilt down to keep doing it. And I felt anxiety, and I felt remorse, and I hadn't even drank yet. You know, the first time I drank, I was in high school, and, you know, I grew up in the 50s when ducktail haircuts were big and leather jackets and stuff, and I wanted to be macho. I don't know how many of you guys wanted to be macho and hang out with the guys. I did. I mean, look at me. I look like Mr. Peepers. He ain't macho. And I wanted to be macho and tough, and everybody scared me, and I was afraid of the dark, and I couldn't tell you. So I when you got too close to me, I had to fight. And I had to ambush you because I couldn't win a fight if I didn't. So I had to hit you with a brick or a club or something, and I felt bad for you, and I had to stuff those feelings. And that's how I grew up in school, was fighting and being afraid and feeling like a wimp. And the first time I drank, I was in high school, I was with my girlfriend, and she brought me a 16-ounce tea glass full of slow gin and 7-Up. And, you know, I took a sip of that back there, and it was a hot summer night. And it tasted like strawberry Kool-Aid, and I like strawberry Kool-Aid. So I chug-a-lugged that glass down, and nothing happened. You hear guys stand up here and say, you know, hey, I got all warm and fuzzy, and that stuff hit my stomach, and I got 6 feet four and all that. You know, that crap didn't happen to me. I drank that glass of slow gin and 7-Up, and I gave her the glass, and I bossed her around. I said, go get me another one, and she did. You know, she brought that glass back, and I drank that one down, and you know, nothing happened. I didn't put on a trench coat. I didn't get a bottle of wine and put it in a paper bag. And I didn't go hang out on Skid Row. You know, none of those things happen that you hear. I just chug-a-lug that and didn't think nothing about it. You know, I drank about a gallon of that stuff in 30 minutes, and nothing happened. You know, I didn't cross some invisible line. I didn't get all drunk and crazy. Till about 25 minutes after that last glass, I found out where slow gin got its name, and I got drunk as hell. And I went into a blackout, and what happened was is I got taken home, and I passed out. And when I woke up, when I come to the next morning, I didn't wake up, I came to, and, you know, I was vomiting this red stuff all over the bathroom, and I had a kind of hangover that I couldn't open my eyes because the light hurt my eyes, and every time Mom and Dad would yell at me, my skin would reverberate, and I just was sicker in hell and throwing up, and I didn't remember what I had done the night before, and I missed 3 days of school. And when I went back to school 3 days later, the guys told me what had happened. And, you know, I thought all those guys that I was with that night drank the way I did. I thought they drank and couldn't remember what had happened. And they told me that some guy left off and I hit him in the face and he went through a screen door and that I was dancing and doing these things. You know, I couldn't remember any of that stuff. And that was a blackout. And I didn't know that back then. I didn't know until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and found out from you folks that a blackout was when I consumed amounts of alcohol that I would continue to function, and then the next morning when I come to, I wouldn't remember the things I had done. Have you ever, any of you ever woke up and looked at that thing next to you and thought, where in the hell did I drag this? It's already been tagged by the park ranger and shit, there it is. And you wonder where in the hell you got it and you can't remember and you're trying... Is that, are the women hissing? I thought it was a tag from the park rangers. It was her earring, I'm sorry. And, you know, it just had her name and serial number on it, and her address, and the fact that she got vaccinated. Well, that's the kind I didn't hang out with lovely women that are in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hung out with the beast in the bar. I hung out with the real dogs. And but, you know, I didn't know what a blackout was, and I consumed amounts of alcohol, and those things happened. And, you know, I didn't file that away. And, you know, I did learn one thing that night, is from that night until this night, I don't drink 7-Up anymore. That's what I learned. Because 7-Up made me sick, and 7-Up made me lose school, and made me lose my memory, and it got me crazy, so I didn't drink 7-Up anymore, and I don't drink it today because it makes me throw up when I do. And so I just continued to fight and get in trouble in school and be macho and tough because I didn't want to be a wimp. And, you know, right before graduation, I didn't know what I was going to do in college, and I had scholarship offers, and I was afraid to go to school because I didn't know what I wanted to be, and I couldn't tell anybody. And I was ashamed because I hadn't learned anything in high school. All I'd learned how to do was fight and be with the girls and try to act macho and be something I wasn't. And so I quit high school a couple of weeks before graduation and joined the Marine Corps. And, you know, I found myself on a train going up to Chicago, and I'm sitting next to some guy that I want to impress. I don't know when you drank if you wanted to impress the people that you were around, but this guy had on a leather jacket with all the zippers and doodads on it. And he had a greasy ducktail haircut, and he had long sideburns, and he had engineer boots on and oily Levi's, and this guy was drinking stuff out of a little brown bottle, and I wanted to impress this guy because I wanted him to like me. I wanted to have a bond with him because he was macho, and I'm sitting there in a leather jacket, and I'm sitting there with my glasses on, and I look like Mr. Peepers, for Christ's sakes, and you know, I feel like a wimp. And this guy says, hey, you want a drink of this? And I said, sure. Now, I don't know how you drank whiskey when you were 17-year-old, but I took that whiskey bottle and I slow gin and 7-Up's all I remember. And I took 3 or 4 big mouthfuls of that stuff and I swallowed it down. And, well, I was 17, and what happened to me was I threw that crap back up and all over the seat in front of me. And I had tears coming out of my eyes and I had snot coming out of my nose. And, you know, I didn't look very macho. And, I wiped my face off and I handed him that bottle back and I said, boy, that was good. And I wanted to fit in with the guy. I wanted the guy to like me and stuff. And he just looked at me funny and I felt inadequate, like a wimp. And, you know, he said, you want another drink? And I said, no, not right now. I couldn't even hardly breathe, for Christ's sakes. And, but I came up out at MCRD San Diego and I was macho and I was with you guys and you guys were all older than I was and I'd been to Chicago and I'd been drunk with the men and I felt like a man, but I had all these feelings of fear and anxiety and homesickness and I couldn't tell you guys about it, so I stuffed those feelings down and I didn't know how I was going to deal with them. I got out of boot camp and I was at Camp Pendleton a while. Then in 1962, October, I found myself on a ship going through the Panama Canal, and I was going to go kill Cubans. I didn't have the luck that they have now. They just go down and just rip Panama off. I didn't get to do that. We're going to go kill Cubans. And I'm afraid on that ship, and I don't know what to do with my fear, and I'm sitting there sharpening my bayonet because I seen John Wayne in the Sands of Iwo Jima. So I'm going to win the Medal of Honor, and I'm sharpening my bayonet, and these guys that I'm with break in the narcotics locker, and they bring me down a little morphine syringe. And I take the plastic cap off, and I put the needle in my leg, and I squeeze that juice out, and I go up on the deck of the ship that night, and I lay out there all night looking at the stars. And I ain't afraid no more. And if you'd have come up to me that night and told me that, hey, Jones, you know that morphine you put in your system did that, I'd have told you you're crazy. That morphine didn't have anything to do with it. I grew up all of a sudden. I just matured, okay? You know, I didn't know back then what I know tonight, that putting that narcotic into my system took the fear away that I was feeling and allowed me to act and be what I thought that you wanted me to be, and I could just go on and put this facade up and not being afraid, you know, because I didn't want to tell anybody how I really felt, and that allowed me to go on and act like I wasn't afraid. And, you know, I didn't take any more dope after that. Don't take any talent to become a heroin addict. All you got to do is just fill up a syringe with heroin, put it in your veins, and shoot it in there. Before long, you'll become addicted, because I don't know any social heroin users. But you got to really hang in if you're going to be an alcoholic. You got to be able to do some things. You can't just drink one beer and come into AA and feel comfortable and a part of. And what you got to be able to do is you got to be able to do, I guess, what all of us did, or we wouldn't be here tonight. You got to be able to drink booze and wet your pants and crap your pants and wet the bed and abuse your wife and your kids and lose your job and sleep in the bushes and get thrown in jail and put in mental institutions and everything. You got to be able to do it one day at a time for years. You're just not going to be able to just drink a beer or two and slip on in the door on us, folks. And, you know, so I didn't use any more heroin, and I didn't get to kill any Cubans, and I found myself in Okinawa. And in Okinawa, first night there, the guy said, let's go get drunk, and I said, let's go. And so I went out with the men to get drunk because I wanted to be with the men. I wanted to be with you guys. And we bought a Typhoon 5th of sake. It held about 2 gallons back then and cost us 75 cents of rot gut stuff. Tastes like Clorox. These guys started passing that stuff around, and they got it to me, and I took that bottle, and it looks like water. Sake looks like water to me. And I took that bottle, and I was thirstier than hell, and it was hot there in Okinawa, and I tipped that bottle up, and I took 4 or 5 big mouthfuls and swallowed it down. Now, I don't know how you drank sake when you were 17, but I can tell you what I did with those 5 or 6 guys standing in front of me. When that last drink, I took that bottle down from my mouth, and when I did, it was a signal for all that crap in my stomach to come up, because I threw all that stuff up all over the guy standing in front of me. And I had tears running out of my eyes and snot running out of my nose. And I'm trying to look macho, and these guys are laughing and poking and pointing at me, and I felt like a wussy. And I didn't want to be a wussy. I didn't want to be any wimp. I wanted to be macho, and that's what I mean. You can't just drink. You know, you can't let looking bad stop you. Can't do it. I had to be here tonight. I kept drinking and throwing it up, and I hung in, and I got enough down. And what happened was I looked at those 5 or 6 guys I was with, and I realized something. I realized that they were all punks. And I didn't need them around me. They were holding me back. I'd outgrew them. And that's what alcohol did for me. Alcohol allowed me to be something I wasn't. Alcohol allowed my mind to work. Alcohol allowed me to fantasize and do the things I wanted to do. And so I went out into the Ville on my own, and I got drunk. And some Marine from another unit said something, so I did what Marines do. I hit him with a pool cue. Felt guilty about that. Ordered a glass of Akadama wine and drank it, and I didn't feel guilty no more. I picked up a little Nason, and her and I tripped off and did what we had to do. I gave her some money. She went to clean up. I stole my money back, set her little hooch on fire, no problem. That's what Marines do. And that's what I thought. And went back to Camp Schwab, passed out. The next morning I got up, I was throwing up, had a hangover. Some of my buddies come up, and they told me what I had done that night, and I started to feel guilty about that. And I didn't know if she got out of that fire. I thought about hitting that other Marine, and I felt anxiety, and I felt guilt and remorse, and I had to stuff those feelings down, and I was throwing up, and I had a headache. And I found out a secret that morning. I went to my locker, and right there was a bottle of Akadama wine. And I found out at the age of 17 that if I took a couple of drinks of wine in the morning, and then I drank some water, that my headache went away. And all those feelings of guilt and anxiety that I was feeling about the things I had done the night before went away. I didn't feel them no more, so I became a morning drinker and a daily drinker at the age of 17. And I went on rip-roaring drunks, and the Marine Corps frowns on that, and I started getting busted, started making rank and losing it, and making rank and losing it. If you'd have told me it was alcohol, I'd have told you you're crazy. Alcohol ain't got nothing to do with it. And I'd have said that it was a CO, or it was them, or it was a situation. You see, I went through life blaming everybody and never looking at me. I never looked at me as being the problem. It was always you. It was her. It was the job. It was the kids. It was always something, but it wasn't Frank Jones. And so that's how I blame people. And that's what I did over. Alcohol wasn't my problem. Marine Corps was my problem. The company gunny was probably my problem. And I knew that young lieutenant was my problem. But it wasn't the booze. And I continued to get in trouble, and I ended up running out of money one day over, and I had to get some money to drink on. And so we decided to rob a cab driver, me and a friend of mine, and I stopped the cab and jerked him out of the cab. And I pinned his head down the pavement, picked up the rock the size of a softball, and I beat his face in with it. And the Marine Corps really frowns on that. And what happened was I got a general court-martial, and my father had to fly to Okinawa and paid for that man's reconstructive surgery and his retirement and all his hospital and medical bills and everything. And I begged the Marine Corps not to throw me out, and they didn't. They sentenced me to 2 years confinement at hard labor and back to duty. Now, you can't do that in the military, and I'm not going to go into a big harangue about what happened. But I spent a year locked up, and by the time the paperwork went through and they let me out, I was here in the States, and I was still in the Marine Corps, and I'd spent a year locked up. And booze wasn't a problem. And what happened was I met a woman and I married her, and when her and I were married, I thought Marines were still macho, and I was still running around bar fighting and getting in trouble, and I'd go home and that wife would start chipping her teeth at me, and then I didn't want to hear her crap, and so I'd start abusing her and yelling and screaming at her, and then I'd have to leave the house and drink so I could be comfortable drinking in the bars. And then I'd go out in the bars and I'd drink, and some guy'd come up and fat mouth, and when he fat mouth, I'd have to hit him with something. Because he irritated the hell out of me, and then I felt bad, and I'd drink some, and I'd meet a woman, and then I'd have to validate my manhood, because my wife ain't treating me right, and then I'd feel bad about being with her, because my wife didn't deserve that kind of treatment. Jesus Christ, I tell you, you get on a roll, and, you know, you got nowhere to go if you're like me, and I'm drinking and fighting and with the women, and then I feel guilt and remorse, and I got to go home, and I look at her, and, you know, what the hell am I going to do, and that's how it was, and I didn't know until I got here with you folks. And found out that she was an individual, and she had the right to do and say what she wanted to do and say, and dress how she wanted to dress, and keep that house how she wanted to keep it, that I wasn't her boss or her god or her director, and that I had no right to do or say the things I was doing. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that she had the right just to be a human being and to be an individual. And then she had a daughter to us, and, you know, kids ain't supposed to cry around me, and I started abusing that family and yelling and screaming at that kid, because the kid makes messes, and it cries, and it does those things, and I don't like that, because I'm a perfectionist, and I don't think kids should act that way, and I got to go out and drink some more. And so there's the vicious cycle I was on, and finally I was getting in enough fights and trouble here at Camp Pendleton, and I got called into the CO's office, and I got issued a rifle, a telescope on it, and some live ammunition, and I got orders, and they sent me a little place called Vietnam. And I got to tell you this, before I get into this, that Vietnam ain't my problem. Wasn't my problem. I was an alcoholic long before I went to Vietnam. I was a morning drinker and a daily drinker, and Vietnam had nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. It's not an excuse. I don't use that as a cop-out or anything else. What it is, it's a two-year part of my life is what it is, and it's a part that was hard, and it's a part that I got through, and it's a part that I use Alcoholics Anonymous with that allows me to live with it today, and it really ain't no big deal. But you see, when we landed in Vietnam, in Da Nang, I was terrified, you see. I was too frightened to tell any of you guys that I was afraid. You know, how can I turn to these Marines I'm going into combat with and tell you, hey, man, I'm afraid? You see, you can't do that. You see, I had to pack that fear down. I had to pack those feelings down inside me. See, I wasn't going to be in the rear with the gear. I wasn't going to be issuing out supplies. I was a sniper, and I was on my way up to Quezon and up on the DMZ, and I was scared to death, and I couldn't tell anybody, and I didn't know how to deal with that because the things I was seeing wasn't registering, and I couldn't handle it emotionally or mentally or mature-wise. And I found out a secret in Vietnam. I found out that if I put 151 proof rum in my canteens and I drank that I became bulletproof and invisible. And I found out that I could do the things I thought you guys thought I should do to validate my manhood and to show you I wasn't afraid and to show you that I could handle seeing what I was seeing over there, and I would drink because then I could do it, and if I didn't drink, I couldn't do it. You see, because I was too terrified and too frightened, and that's how I went through that over there. And finally, in March of 1968, you know, I'd done all the things you read about in Time Magazine and Newsweek, and I don't bring it up because I'm proud of it, because I'm not, but I had to do it, and then after I did it, I had to drink to get rid of the memories and the guilt and the remorse and the shame that I felt after I did those things. And in March of 1968, during the siege of Quezon, I got wounded, and I got blown up, and I ended up back here in the States, and while I'd been over, my wife had a son born to us while I was on Hill 881, and I wanted it quiet in that house, and they wouldn't get quiet, and I was drinking and nuts, and I was 3 days out of the hospital, and I told that woman if she didn't shut up, I'd kill her, and you know, she didn't shut up. And so I went to the closet, and I got a gun out, and I come back in there. I had a two-and-a-half-year-old daughter that was crying and telling me don't shoot her mom, and a little boy about 10 months old that was crying, and you know, I was just drunk and crazy, and that woman kept chipping her teeth at me and running her mouth, and she wouldn't shut up. And you know, I got to believe that there was a God in the house that day. You see, and I had quit believing in God, because if there was a God, I was screwed. You see, I'd already broke all 10 of the commandments. I'd done enough bad things in Vietnam that if there was a God, I was going to hell anyway, so it didn't make any difference. But there was a God in that house that day, and I found that out since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you see, the safety wouldn't come off that gun, And I kept jacking around with it, and the spring jumped out the back, and I pushed that spring back in, and the gun went off. And those kids were standing on each side of me, and that bullet went through my hand and down between my feet where those kids were standing, and the bullet didn't hit either one of them. You see, and I'm blessed for that, because that could have killed either one of those children. And there ain't no doubt, even standing here tonight, that I'd have killed my wife. That night, I'd have killed her. I was drunk and I was crazy, and shortly after that, she divorced me. I know you'll find that hard to believe. You know, it ain't like I fired the whole clip. I fired one round. You know, the damn gun held 14 rounds. I could have fired all 14. But I fired one. I'm disciplined. And, you know, and I didn't even shoot her. I shot myself, for Christ's sakes. And she ran off with a state policeman from Indiana, and she took the kids, and I drank over that for a long time. And, you know, I ended up on the drill field down in San Diego, and I was a drill instructor, and I was a liar and a cheat and a thief down there, and I'm not very proud of that. See, I had to have money to drink on, and I didn't have any other way to get it. And, you know, I met another woman down there, and, you know, after 2.5 years in the States, I was suicidal and crazy, and I wanted to commit suicide, and I didn't have the guts, and I was still drinking and fighting in the bars. And so I decided to get off the drill field after 2.5 years, and I thought the only way to die would be go back to Vietnam, so I did that. I volunteered, and I went back to Vietnam, and I got with an infantry unit, and a lot of bad things happened over there this time. And, you know, the only reason I bring it up, a lot of times veterans, they come up and talk to me after the meeting, and, you know, they tell me they can't stay sober. They say they've done a lot of bad things to a lot of people over there, and they say, you know, I have a hard time staying sober. I can't get this thing, man. I got all this guilt, and I got these feelings and stuff, and, you know, I got to stand there and tell them, whether I'm speaking here around Camp Pendleton or down in San Diego, that, you know, I've read this thing right here called Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book, I've read it several times, and it says in there that if you work the 12 steps in your life, that if you apply the 12 steps and you go to a lot of meetings and you get into action in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you develop a conscious contact with some type of higher power, and that you work these steps to the best of your ability, that you can stay sober no matter what. And it doesn't say that if you've done a lot of bad things to a lot of people a lot of times, you can't stay sober. You know, it doesn't say that anywhere in that book. And I got to stand there and tell those guys that are telling me they can't stay sober because some crap they did overseas. I got to tell them that they're not staying sober because they don't want to stay sober, and they had to quit using that shit as a cop-out. Because, you see, Alcoholics Anonymous has worked for me for almost 9 years, and people ain't done anything any worse or any better than I have. I'm just a drunk. And I had to do the things I had to do to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found that if I do the things that that book outlines, that I'm going to be able to stay sober and stay comfortable. And I learned that in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous from people like you. Because, you see, I've done the fourth step and the fifth step and all that stuff come out. And what it was fear. And what it was shame. And what it was resentment. And what it was remorse. And it was all the defects of character and everything that I never knew I had. And that I never knew I was drinking over. So I got to tell them that if they want to stay sober, they can. You know, I got shot up again after that. And I came back, and after 11 years, I drank myself out of the Marine Corps. And I was married again now, and I was abusing that wife, and we had a daughter. And I don't know what you do, but when I'm macho and tough, and I spent 11 years in the Marine Corps, and I'm a big deal combat veteran, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm starting to urinate blood now and vomit a little blood, I strapped on a gun and a badge and became a cop. And I took that bad attitude out on the street with me. And, you know, I couldn't tell my partner in that police car that I was afraid of the dark. How can I tell somebody I'm afraid of the dark? I mean, that macho guys can't do that. And I can't sit there and say, hey, man, let's don't go down this alley. I'm afraid. Can we stop and maybe give me a short dog and a beer or something, man? You know, there might be something jump out at me. You know, I couldn't do that. And I had all these feelings and all this fear. And when I didn't drink, I had these memories. And I had these things. And I had these nightmares and stuff. And so I had to drink to get rid of that crap. And, you know, I got my wife pregnant again. And I was abusing that family. And I had to validate myself. And I started having an affair with my female partner, for Christ's sakes. And, she found out I got my wife. I always have to validate myself. I'm never enough. I'm never enough. I don't know about you. I don't know if you were faithful. You probably were. I wasn't. I was a liar and a cheat and a thief, and I went for me. And I had to validate myself with her, and she found out I got my wife pregnant, and the silly broad shot me and ended my police career. Can you believe that? I just can't believe it. A police woman shot me. We used to run around in our gun belts naked and handcuffed and drunk and... I don't even know why I said that. Is this being taped, Dick? Cut that part out. She shot me. And that ended my police career. And I got to tell you that Carlsbad brings out the worst in me. But she shot me in the head, and that ended my police career, and I got a real estate license. And if you think money, property, and prestige will fix it, it doesn't, because I had a Cadillac. I had two of them. My wife had one. And We had a house on a quarter acre and a swimming pool in the back corner. There was a three-hole putting green that I had designed with the house, and I was making six figures a year, and I was dying and going crazy and fighting in the bars and abusing that family and nailing the window shut and doing all the things that a chronic drunk does. And at the age of 36-year-old, I looked around and everything I'd worked all my life to get was gone. Everything I'd worked to get was gone. That house was gone. The two Cadillacs were gone. My Mr. T starter kit was gone. I had a bunch of gold chains and diamond rings. I pawned those, and the wife and kids were gone. They moved up into a trailer with her parents in San Jose, and it was just hideous, and I couldn't figure out what the hell my problem was, so I changed brands of cigarettes. And I had a 42-inch waist, and I was turning yellow, and I was crazier than hell. All I wanted to do all my life is be like my father. You know, my father's a good man. He's a decent man, and he just was a good example. And, I wanted to be like him, and I don't know where in the hell I went wrong, and I didn't know what my problem was, and the wife and kids and everything I'd worked to get was gone, and everything I owned was in a cardboard box in the back seat of the stolen car, and I couldn't figure out what my problem was. And if you'd have told me drinking was my problem, I'd have told you you're crazy. Alcohol ain't got anything to do with this. If I could just get a little more money, some woman to take care of me, maybe get a second on her house, and, give me some coins, to get me started again, and get me a new Cadillac, and somebody to take care of me and love me, and I'd be all right. You know, I didn't know I had this disease called alcoholism, and I didn't know that I was dying. Because this is a disease of denial, and it's the only disease that's killing you. Your head says you ain't got a problem with it, and it's everything else around you that's going to hell, not you. And alcohol's not my problem, and I continued to drink, and I ended up in this woman's closet that had taken me in drinking in her closet, and I was sicker than a dog, and I ended up vomiting blood all over her bedroom, and I had a cocked 357 Magnum on the nightstand, and I cocked it, and I put it in my mouth, and I wanted to pull the trigger, and I didn't have the guts. And I was dying, and I didn't know what the hell my problem was, and I was going to kill her and her kids and then commit suicide because, you see, the world outside these rooms would become unbearable for me and my thoughts, and I drank and my head wouldn't shut off. And I kept thinking and thinking and thinking, and I had a kaleidoscope of this crap in my head and I couldn't get rid of it. And when I drank alcohol, nothing happened. I just got sicker and I just continued to die inside. And I went to a doctor finally, and he told me that I was dying and that I was an alcoholic. And, I felt relief when he told me that. And, he said I had a hole in my throat, cirrhosis of the liver, and a lung and stomach infection, all the things that go along with being a chronic drunk. They told me if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And, I drank for 2 more months as hard and as fast as I could because I wanted to die. And to make a long story short, I ended up in a hospital in Indiana. And they lashed me down to this bed, and they started pumping me full of vitamin B and magnesium. And they called my wife in California here, and they said, you better come back to Indiana. I said, we don't think your husband's going to live. He's physically addicted to alcohol the way a heroin addict is to heroin, and his DTs are really bad. And I just give my wife, you understand, about 9.5 good years. And when they told her to come back, you know what she said to that doctor? She told that doctor, let that son of a bitch die. I was absolutely crushed when I heard that. I'd give her good years. I mean, she had a Cadillac. She had a house and swimming pool and designer clothes. I mean, I gave her everything. And she wouldn't come back to visit me when I was dying. I didn't die, so it ain't a big deal. I'll tell you what, this year we'll be married 19 years. And she's my wife, and she's my lover, and she's my best friend. And we got God, A, and Al-Anon in our home, and if we didn't, we wouldn't have a home. And that's the way it's become in sobriety for her and I. But I didn't die, and I ended up in another part of the hospital, and I ended up going to AA meetings, and in those meetings what I heard was go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Go to AA. If you want to take a drink of alcohol, go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard that over and over and over again. And after a period of time, I got out of the hospital, and I walked outside in the Indiana sun, and I started crying. And, all the things I had done all my life came down and started choking me out, and they fell on my chest. I'd abused that wife and those kids and the things in Vietnam and the people I'd abused when I was a cop and the lying and cheating and stealing and the Ten Commandments I broke, and I didn't want to take a drink. I just got suicidal. And so I'm not going to go to AA because they said go to AA if you want to drink. And I didn't want to drink. I wanted to commit suicide. And if I felt good about me, then I thought maybe, well, hell, I'll kill you. Because I feel good about me, and that's how I was, and I didn't go to AA for 13 months. And what happened is, if you're drunk the way I am, I don't know what kind of drunk you are, I don't know, maybe you quit drinking and your life's okay. You know, I know some of you, your life ain't okay, because I know a lot of people in here tonight, and your life ain't okay. Well, it is now, but it wasn't. But I just didn't go to AA for 13 months, and I got a little bit stressed. I got a little intense. And I'm calm now. AA's has serene me out. I'm serene tonight. I'm serene every night in Alcoholics Anonymous. But since I didn't go to AA for 13 months, I got worse instead of better. And one day, some guy come up and said, "How you doing?" And you know, I took that personal. I thought maybe he was prying into my damn life. I don't know, who are you to ask me how I'm doing? And I almost choked the guy to death, and I flipped out in his office, and I just went nuts because I hadn't been doing anything about my life. I got my wife and kids back. We were living in the garage and sleeping on the floor and eating out of a styrofoam chest, and I was abusing that family still, and I had a girlfriend, and I was driving a stolen car, and I was still a liar and a cheat and a thief, but I ain't drank, but I hadn't changed anything. And so after 13 months, I flipped out. I went crazy. And this guy in this office was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he come up and he said, "I know what's wrong with you." He said, "Man, I can't help you." He said, "You scare hell out of me. You're frightening." And I told him, "Get away from me, I'll kill you. I'm not frightening. You're starting to make me crazy." And he gave me a card with a phone number on it. I couldn't call. I stood around and I cried and I shook. And these guys watched me and stuff. And they stayed at the house with me. And after a week or so, I ended up down talking to this guy. And I sat in his office and I cried. And I hadn't had anything to drink in 13 months. And what that man explained to me is that I didn't have a problem with drinking. He told me that I had a problem with living. And he said that I should find a living answer to my living problem. And he suggested that I go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous to find that. And he said that if I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I started reading this big book, that he says I would get a lot more comfort in my life and a lot more peace and a lot more serenity, and I wouldn't have to drink or go crazy. Because he said the only problem is he says you can't deal with the things that are going on outside. And he says you're either going to drink or go nuts. And he told me that I had to become committed to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me that I had to come to AA every night. He said I had to come into these rooms and shake hands with you. He told me that I had to stick my hand out because if I did that, it'd get my sick mind off my sick self. He told me that I had to start reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he suggested that I read the black part, not the white. And he suggested I start at page one and read it all the way through. And he suggested that I start working these steps in my life on a daily basis. And he said, "I don't want you working the steps in the meetings," because he said it's easy in there. He said, "I want you to work the steps when you leave the meetings. I want you to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at home with your family. I want you to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous at work when you get a job, because you're going to have to get one. You have to be self-supporting," he told me. And I didn't know how to do anything. And he told me that I had to start believing in a God. He told me that somebody hung the moon out at night and they took it down in the morning and he advised me it wasn't me. And that come as a shock to me. I was so damn tired in the morning, I figured I had to be wrestling with that damn thing. And what he told me that I had to do is I had to start changing how I was living. He told me, he says, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a cowboy shirt and I had on cowboy boots and I had a big mustache and I had long hair and I smelled like a buffalo. And my sponsor said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Illinois." And he said, "You're not a cowboy." Now, goddamn it, that hurt me. And he says, "I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous now, and in 2 weeks it'll be 9 years. All you old-timers, all you've done, all my time in Alcoholics Anonymous has hurt me. You've told me the things that I'm not. I'm not a cowboy. I'm not macho. I'm from Illinois. I'm a wimp, and it's just okay." And that ain't an answer. That ain't an answer for me. You told me that I had to start paying my bills. You told me I had to register to vote. You told me that I had to get car insurance and I had to get a driver's license, for Christ's sake. And I didn't understand those things. And what I did when I came into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is I met you. And when I met you, what you did was stick your hand out to me. And what you did was that you told me to sit down and have a cup of coffee and relax. And you told me I didn't have to hurt myself anymore. Nobody come up and said what kind of car you're driving, what kind of bank account you got, how much money you're making, what'd you do in Vietnam, how'd you treat your wife and kids. None of you has asked me that. What you did was you said, "Come on in and sit down and take care of yourself here." You showed me how to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You showed me how to get commitments. You told me that a commitment for me should be that I show up to the meeting unless there's a death in the family and it's mine. See, I understand that kind of talk. You told me don't get any high-profile commitments. You told me to sweep and swab the decks in the meetings or clean ashtrays or clean the coffee pots. You told me to make the meeting mine because you said that way I got to come and check on it. Because if it ain't my meeting, I don't care how it's run. But he said, if it's your meeting, and you told me if it's your meeting, I got to come to check on you. And so I started coming to these meetings. You told me to sit up in the front and take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth. And you told me to listen. You told me that I didn't have any answers. And what you did more than that is you set an example for me. You see, because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know how to act. I had filed for divorce from my family. My kids were frightened of me. I didn't know how to treat people. I was angry. I was hostile. was a liar, I was a cheat, I was a thief, and I was guilty about everything. And I had a past that none of you people had. And I didn't know how to cope with or deal with it. And you pointed out how to work the 12 steps for me. And what you did is you showed me by your example. What you said to me didn't mean a lot, but how you acted meant the world to me. Because you see, when I came in these meetings and I watched you come in and I watched you put your arms around each other. And you see, there wasn't anybody hugging me when I got here. I understand why. I didn't then, but I do now. But I watched you put your arms around each other and I watched you hold each other. And I watched you with your wives and your girlfriends and your husbands. And I watched how you treated them. And I watched how you held their hand and how you kissed them. And how you looked at them and how you were kind and gentle with them. And then when I went home, you told me, when you go home, we want you to treat your wife that way. And I couldn't do that because, you see, I didn't love my wife. And you told me, we don't care whether you love her or not. You treat her that way, and in time, you'll learn to love her. You told me to take actions, and then in time, if I took the actions, that my thinking would change. And so I started taking that home with me, what you showed me here. And I started reaching out and touching my wife. And it took a long time, but after a couple of years, I started loving her. And I started feeling something for her, and I started caring about her when I asked her how she was doing and what happened in her day to day, and I started listening to her. And she started going to Al-Anon, and we started having God A and Al-Anon on our own. And you know, I watched her when you come in here with your children, and I watched how you put your arms around your kids, and I watched how you treated them, and I watched how you let them be kids, because you see, my kids couldn't be kids around me. They had to be little adults. They had to be perfectionists. They had to be perfect. And you know, that ain't how kids are, you see, because I found out from you that kids make messes. And that kids do things, and the kids make noise, and the kids play, and kids lose things, and kids break things, and kids don't take care of stuff. And you told me that it was okay, because that's what kids do. And you know, you told me to take that home with me and try to treat my kids that way. You see, and I went home, and I had kids, I had two daughters at home living with me. And, you know, my oldest daughter would say, I love you, Dad. And you know, I couldn't tell her that I loved her when she was going to bed. And you told me to start telling her. And I watched you with your kids, and you told your kids you loved them. And I watched you kiss your kids. And so I went home and I tried to kiss my kids. And, you know, they run from me for a while. And when my daughter said, I love you, Dad, I said, I love you too. And, you know, I didn't feel nothing. But, you know, I kept doing it. And, you know, one night after doing that for a number of months and for about a year, I said, I love you. And you know what? I felt something. I got tears in my eyes. And, you know, she looked at me. And I went over in the hallway and I hugged her. And, you know, she hugged me back. And I had a little one that used to run and hide in her bedroom when I came home. And I was 3 years sober until that little one crawled up on my lap and kissed me and told me she loved me. But one night she did it. I was 3 years sober because I kept going home and I kept taking you with me. And when I got home, I tried to be kind and I tried to be gentle and I tried to be a husband and a father at home because you told me to do that. And, you know, now I've been sober about 9 years. And like I said last year, you know, my little girl, she's 12 now and she took golf lessons so she'd be with me. You can't beat that, man. And she took me to school with her, and I went into junior high, and I didn't cry with all the other parents this time. I kind of stood tall. I still got her and the other kids in trouble that we were with, but that's all right. They like me. My oldest daughter's applying at colleges, and she got her license, and she drives the car, and I let her have my car, and you said it's okay that she's got a God in her life the same as me, and, you know, she's getting good grades, and she's changed, and what they've got in their home today is they got a program. And they got a father that's not a maniac most of the time. You know, that teenager, she worries me. Because, you see, have you ever been in a teenager's bedroom? I walk by her bedroom, and it is trashed. The drawers are open. Her pantyhose are hung out. The curling iron's hung there. There's five or six towels from her hair being dried. The bed ain't made. There's blankets on the floor. There's posters. There's crap all over. There's empty glasses and cookie wrappers and zingers. And I get crazy. And I used to go home and yell and scream at her, clean the damn thing up. What's wrong with you? What you did was is you told me a secret that I didn't know until I got here with you. You said, you don't have to look at that crap. Why don't you just close the door? I close the door. I don't have to see it. I don't have to look at it. It's her room. I'm not going to change my 17-year-old daughter with any pearls of wisdom today. She's 17. You know what she does when I say, what the hell? Why do you keep your room that way? I still fold my crap in 4-inch lengths and put them in the drawer. My suits are hung by color with the shirts buttoned all facing the hangers the same way. I said, Trace, why can't you do that? She said, Dad, that room ain't the biggest thing in my life. School is. What? What do you mean? That's how you're going to be at school. She said, no, I'm not. I'm 3.5 at school. And I'm captain of the cheerleaders. That's what I am at school. She said, I don't have time for my room. I'm busy learning to be an adult at school. What can I say to her? I can tell her what you told me to tell her. I love you, babe. And whip it on. That's what I can tell her, and that's what you give me. And the other thing I got to tell you is that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't just a bowl of cherries and roses. You know, I told you last year I had a son in prison that he shot a man. Well, that son got out of prison in August. He spent 4.5 years locked up, and I had thrown him out when he was 15-year-old. And he got out of prison in August, and I took him to my meetings up there in West L.A. And, you know, he looked at you people, and he was strong and macho, and he was a tough guy, and he seen you foxy ladies. And he took off on that crap. And, you know, I haven't seen him since then. And I got a letter from this parole officer. There's a warrant for his arrest. And I heard that he's carrying a gun now and driving a stolen car. And you know that the same thing he told me when he was locked up. He said, just stand still and stay in AA. And just be an example. And, you know, that's what I'm doing. And, you know, it eats me up inside because he's my only son and I love him. And I want him to get this. But it ain't time yet, evidently. You know, he's got a God in his life just like I got in mine. You know, who am I to chastise him for being violent and crazy? Look at me when I was 22. What can I tell that kid? I can't tell him anything. I was doing that. And, you know, my father has got his blood clot and his Alzheimer's. He's now in the hospital. And I went back there earlier this year, and I got to be a support to him. And he told me to go back and suit up, show up, support my mom, and I did. And I love my mom. I love my dad. And that woman I tried to shoot, I made an amends to her. And at my daughter's wedding in April of this year, and you know, I went to my ex-mother-in-law and I made amends to her. That was a tough one. I didn't have to mean it, I just had to take the action. I don't care if the bitch drops dead. I made amends to her. And you know, life goes on today, and what I have to do is I have to be an example. And you know, it's like my sponsor says that this day coming up Monday, December 25th, is another day. And what I have to do is just stay here with you. I have to stay here and I have to learn from you because you've taught me everything I know, because I don't know anything left of my own devices. I came here and I learned and I tried to follow your example and I tried to act the way you taught me to act. And whether I'm good or bad, I'm a product of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like I like to say, I have not talked for you tonight, I've talked for me. You see, I need to remember what I used to be like. And I need to remember how very lucky and fortunate I am to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I could have missed this deal. And then I need to remember what it's like for me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a blessed man, you see. I'm a blessed man to be here with you people and to have the chance I've gotten to have the family that I have and to be married to that woman for almost 19 years and to watch those kids grow up and to amount to something and to be a member of society. And I'm grateful for that. And I really am. I could be a cheerleader for Alcoholics Anonymous. But if you're new tonight and you're one of those folks that raise their hand as a newcomer in their first 30 days, you don't have to remember anything I said. What I said tonight is not important to you at all. What you should have heard tonight is that first line read in chapter 5, and that's what you should remember tonight in every meeting you go to. And what that first line in chapter 5 says is, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thank you. Yes, sir. Hi, Clay. I read it the first 2 or 3 years I was sober and didn't understand it, even as simple as it was written, because I'm not very sharp and I couldn't concentrate. And I couldn't, my thoughts, I couldn't track them, so when I read it, they didn't mean anything. What I started to do is I started to read the big book again every January on my birthday. And then every June, I try to read the book twice a year. And it didn't start meaning anything to me until I had almost 5 years of sobriety. Now, that's not something that you need to tell a newcomer or somebody. But I can only tell you that's the way it was for me. What I got in my first years of sobriety is I watched the old-timers. I watched how they acted in the meetings. And that's where I learned. Because reading it, I couldn't comprehend it. And, maybe I'm a dummy. But I got to see you do it. And when I seen you do it, then I could do it. And I just kept, I wanted to be an actor all my life. And so I just acted like you acted. But it took me about 4 or 5 years to start understanding what was in that big book. Yes, Cliff. Hi, Cliff. Last Saturday? You see, what I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm going to always have the feelings that I've got. And what I've learned from you folks and from reading this book and trying to work these steps in all my affairs is, and what my sponsor tells me is, I can think anything I want to think, I just can't act on it. And what I have to do is I have to do a lot of thinking instantaneous. And I get so mad I white out. I get so goddamn crazy with it that I have to remember that I'm not willing to pick that tab up, and that I've got to pray right then. I've got to just pray then and walk away from it. I can't stand there. I don't have the luxury with my temper to debate you over something. And I got to walk because it ain't worth it. Then I have to come back and make amends to you and talk to you about it. But I still get mad. I still get crazy. I still get... Driving down here tonight, there was a dummy on the freeway. Why are they out there? With all the snipers we had shooting people on the freeway, they missed this one. Now, I haven't hit anybody in almost 4 years. I haven't hit anybody. I don't have the luxury of doing that. And as long as I know now, and I've been around long enough now to know when people are starting to push my buttons, I back off. And I even tell my wife now, when she gets me crazy, I tell her, I want to tell you something, Jude, right now. I'm loving you as hard as I can. That's all. I'm loving you hard. That's usually enough. And we laugh and hug each other, but I don't have the luxury to get mad. I get mad, but I can't act on it. I really can't act on it. There's not a secret to it. You ring that bell again, I'll kill you. Take the bell and jam it in your ass, pal. No. I was kidding, Carlos. I'm sorry. I paid for the stolen car. My brother found out who the car belonged to, and he paid him for me in Indiana, and then I sent my brother $50 a month. A lot of people asked me that. Did you ever pay for a stolen car? No, I'm still driving the son of a bitch. I paid for it. Yes, sir. Hi, Greg.
Five years.
See, what happened was, is I concreted all my feelings. I had to have this facade and this face and this attitude with the things I'd done. And I pushed those feelings down inside me for a long time. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a honeymoon my first year because I absolutely loved the freedom I had, the freedom from all the feelings and anxiety and the guilt and everything, and the fellowship that I received in my group. It's like this one. It's a big group, and there's a lot of laughter and a lot of hugging, a lot of good people in the meeting. And so I was overwhelmed with that, and I didn't have to think about my past. And I did the fourth and fifth step, and a lot of things didn't come up in that. And then what happened was, is as I went along, I started seeing things on television, and I started becoming honest with myself. The one part of my life I wouldn't deal with was Vietnam, because I was ashamed of the fact I was afraid. I was ashamed of the things that I had done over there. They're macho, and I laughed about them and stuff, and now I laugh about them in the group, and my sponsor kids me about it now and says I bayonet babies and stuff, but I don't. I never did. Set them on fire, but no, I didn't. No, I didn't. For Christ's sake, I didn't do that. But what I had to do at about 5 years is I went crazy, and I got nuts over it, and I went to my sponsor, and I sat in his office, and I talked to him about it, and I went to see the movie Platoon. And I sat there and I cried and I cried and I cried. And what he told me was, is doesn't it feel good to know that you don't have to be a veteran the rest of your life? That you can let go of that. And you don't have to carry that around anymore. And you know, I looked at that and I thought about that. And he says, do you realize that you can, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous wants to go back and change something in their life that they've done. I drowned one of my own men in Vietnam. I was responsible for him drowning. And I just had a hard time with that. And I did not know how I was going to make amends for that because I don't know where his family is and stuff. And I just couldn't deal with all of it. And what happened was, is I was told, and me and my sponsor prayed about it. And I went with him when he went several places to speak. One of them was in San Diego. And he said, we cannot change the past no matter how bad we want to change it. And he said, there's things in your life you want to change. And I said, yes. And he says, but you can't go back and change it. The man I drowned or I was responsible for him drowning that day than when the boat tipped over. I'd love to change that. That man was 18. He had a son, and he's never got to see him. And that's the toughest thing I did. And he said, you can't change that. That's the past. And he says, you have to let God have that. And, you know, I come up with a realization. He says, you find a way to make amends to him. You know, I did. And God works in strange ways in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went and spoke in Texas this year, down in Houston. And I called my sponsor a year or so ago, and I told him, I'm going to go to Washington, D.C. to the well, and I'm going to find that man's name, and I'm going to make amends to it. And I said, as soon as I can save my money. And I lost the company we had. My partner took it up his nose, and we lost all our money and everything in sobriety 2 years ago, so I ain't been able to go. Well, I was speaking in Houston, Texas, and there's a lot of veterans there at this conference. And they come up to me after the meeting, and they said, hey, man, moving walls here. And they took me down there, and I found that man's name on the wall, and I made my amends. And when I walked away from that wall, that chapter was closed, and I felt good about it. Because, you know, if I could change it, and I told him, I said, Richard, if I could change it, I would, but I can't. And I said, I'm sorry. And I walked. So you can get over anything. You can have, you see, it's okay to have feelings and emotions about anything we've done. If you stole something and you feel guilty, that guilt is no different than the guilt I feel from that instant. You see, guilt is guilt. There's no degree. Anger's anger, what Cliff said, you know, when you get mad. Mad's mad. We just do it differently. And you know, the feelings I have, crying about it is okay. I'm not ashamed to cry anymore. I don't have to be macho. That's a sad thing in my life to think about it. But if I change it, I could. But I can't. And so I live with it. And, I still, every January the 7th on my birthday, I say a prayer for him and his family, and I do that for all the people that I owe amends to that I've been able to make them personally to, and it helps you. And just leave it in the past. That's where it is. You're safe with us. Huh. You bet.